And we're speaking with Kendall Hale, former Madison 60s activist and trade union activist in the Boston area, and now living in Asheville, North Carolina, speaking here in Madison tomorrow, Saturday, from noon to 1:30 in the Orpheum Stage Door Theater as part of the Wisconsin Book Festival, talking about her brand new book, Radical Passions, A Memoir of Revolution and Healing. Welcome to Labor Radio.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Now, the book chronicles your development as an activist from being a young sort of combative teenager to coming here to Madison and becoming radicalized by the politics. But then you went on to, after a little bit of traveling, went on to the East Coast of the Boston area and got involved in the trade union movement. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that time first off. What led you as an activist to want to don a welding helmet and get into some of the dirty, harsh environment of the shipyards in the Boston area?
Well, after I left Madison and eventually did end up in Boston, I went to a graduate school program called Cambridge Goddard. It was an extension of Goddard College. And in that college, I took a class on the history of working women. The person who was teaching the class was also a Madison activist who had moved to Boston. And interestingly enough, her agenda, her true agenda, we did study history, but her true agenda was to introduce us to Marxist-Leninist theory. And she did. She took it right in and had us read, you know, some of the works of Lenin. And at the same time, she was organizing a union drive at an electronics plant in Cambridge outside Harvard Square. And she actually really did recruit each one of us out of the class to go into this factory. And we were working for like $2 an hour. And that was part of, I guess, just my conversion. It really was a conversion, because up until that time, I knew about labor history, of course. I knew a lot about labor history, academically speaking. And I had been interested in what some of the new communist movement parties were talking about. And there were people in Madison who had actually gone to Racine, I believe, and Milwaukee into factories. And I remember they were a bit older than I was, and I remember being very curious about why they were going there. But as history had it, I ended up doing the same thing, but just through a course, an introductory course that was then directing us into this union drive. And we did several. I have a chapter on one of the drives that was an interesting episode where we didn't succeed, and there's a whole description of different leftist groups that were there at the time with a worker from the United Electrical Workers, a union organizer. So that really was the motivation. It was completely theoretical, and it was a belief that I felt very passionate about, that this, unlike the people who kind of went in a direction where they decided bombings and trashings and that kind of thing, and capturing bank robbery, Brinks, that wing of a SDS split. I really was, I guess it was because my class background was much closer to, my parents were moderate middle class people, and I was in a Marxist study group here in Madison before I went there, and it just made a lot of sense. So the idea of a communist party or a labor party, to me, just felt like the right thing to be doing. It was the way that we could, you know, have a revolution that was, and it was not like a quick fix. I at that point realized that it was going to take years and years, but that I was going to dedicate my life to being in this cadre, and then move from that situation into the shipyard when that particular experience, after several different failed union organizing attempts in the lower paid sector, mostly women. I was kind of tired of not having a regular job and getting laid off and getting fired at various times, or having blow-ups happen around sectarianism. And I wanted a higher paid job. I wanted a more skilled job. And the General Dynamics shipyard was, you know, there was an affirmative action. So they did hire 50 women. And I was one of 50 women among 5,000 men, and worked there. It was about 2 years, 2.5 years. And that's how I got to the shipyard.
Talk about that a little bit, about being in that wave of affirmative action hires and being a woman in a really male-dominated workplace. I mean, even in spite of the political background and some of the class background differences with other workers, you had that gender issue as well.
Yes, it was very intense. And unlike the other work I had done, it was mostly women. So, and of course, these men had, I mean, some of the older men might have been working there when the women who were allowed to work there during the war, there might have been that Rosie the Riveter era, but that had been a long time before. So it was very tough. There was a lot of, I mean, they just didn't feel comfortable. You know, they hadn't seen women dressed in all of these incredible layers of clothing and using the equipment and just being around them. It was distracting to them. It was, you know, somewhat threatening. There were a lot of blacks and minorities hired at the same time, and we were all brought in and trained as welders, which was actually kind of the dirtiest. It was a skill, but it was a harder job than the ship fitters and some of the other, the burners and some of the other, it seemed as a more white men were in those jobs. So the class of the welders were sort of looked down on anyway by the other more skilled parts of the sectors of the workforce there. But I think there was a double edge. There was a real curiosity too, and there was that flip side of, like, my supervisor was very protective. You know, once he got me on his crew, there was kind of this protective, paternalistic way of keeping sort of an eye on me all the time and trying to keep tabs of, I mean, you know, there, and it was kind of a real need in a way, because there were just so many men and there were so few women, and it was dangerous. It was a very dangerous place to work, and people were injured a lot, and there were occasionally people who died from cranes that fell and crashed, and you know, there it was a hazardous place. But I think it was, for me, it was more the sexual harassment that I experienced in a very, it was very intimidating. And I had never experienced that direct sort of, you know, I'd go to my toolbox and there would be Playboy magazines and pinups that were put all over the walls. And then you'd be climbing through these bulkheads and these tunnels and hauling these lines and, like, doing all work. I mean, we weren't given any easier jobs for the most part. As a welder, we did have to haul our own lines, and we were crawling back in these places, and then you would look up and you would see these chalk drawings of vaginas and breasts, and, you know, it was just gross. I mean, it was just, like, horrifying to, like, you know, be seeing these things on the wall of naked women. Just, it just felt like it was very targeted. It felt like it was very targeted. And so it was just, it was tough. It was a very difficult place. But the way I survived that was to, I met this amazing woman who was not from, she was a working class woman who was very tough, and tougher than I was, and had just come from a different background. And so I kind of became very close, and I worked with her. She was my co-worker, and I feel like I survived a lot because of working with her and staying with her a lot. And that changed everything, just to be able to have one other woman who was just really, this woman was really tough, and she was actually gay. So it was really interesting. It was very interesting. And it was fortunate that I did get to work with her.
Now, the politics of the working class at that time, I mean, that's the era of, you know, the movie Joe, and thinking about working people as being very, very reactionary politically. That's the generation of working people that elected Ronald Reagan, only to be surprised when he fired all the air traffic controllers. What about organizing in that situation? What kind of political hurdles did you find yourself facing?
Well, I think what was really hard was, my impression looking back is that a lot of the older white men, they just wanted to get out. I mean, they were waiting for their retirement, for the pension plan. You know, they were worn out. I mean, they had worked there for so long. It was a tough, tough place. The winters are probably as cold as Madison. I mean, it was just brutal. And I just think that the union, first of all, was very corrupted. So it was really a difficult situation to come into to try to promote union democracy because, I mean, the union and the older white workers, I think they just really kind of, the company and the union, it was almost like a company union, it seemed to me. And the women and the young are black and minority people, and then the leftists, there are so many young leftists there. And the younger workers who were, might have been our age, in their 20s, they just sort of had a party attitude. You know, they were stoned a lot. I was one of the straightest people on the job. I never got stoned, and I never drank. I mean, I was just, like, so proper and so in control of my consciousness all the time and so aware. I had to be. I felt like I had to be. And I had no interest, and I was a very serious political Marxist-Leninist, I was actually a feminist too, but I had to be very serious. And a lot of the younger people to have someone come in like me and start talking to them about retirement benefits and, you know, things that they just didn't have any interest. They just wanted to work and then go to the beach, the Quincy South Shore Beach. And I think most of them felt like they weren't going to stay there that long. So they weren't interested in the union issues at all. I mean, so it was this very odd thing to have this young, I was 26 years old, 27 years old, talking about all these issues that they could care less about and wondering, why did I care? And, you know, and then the older workers, I think, weren't militant in the least. So it was really pretty difficult. I mean, we did have a strike. But I remember I have photographs of the picket line, and it was mostly young leftists on the picket line with a scattering. Some of the older workers, and there were almost no younger workers on the picket lines. So
now, eventually you left the shipyard and moved on in your organizing work to other areas. What kind of lessons did you draw out of that in terms of the kind of political change that you were trying to create and sort of superimposing it on the United States working class at that time in history?
Well, I remember there's this one passage in my book, in the Yardbird chapter, where it was the working conditions were just so absolutely brutal. And this was in the middle of the winter. I just remember thinking, I have nothing that I can do for these people. I am just one of them, and I can't change anything. I can't even really improve the conditions they work under, never mind build a political party and overthrow a capitalist government. I mean, it just felt like, well, you know, I'm glad I came into these places to work, because I would never have understood class struggle. I mean, because I felt like every day it really was a class struggle there for people to survive, just getting through the day every day. And if I hadn't done that, I never would have understood the theory of what I was talking about. And so I think it was an invaluable experience, and it changed my life. It completely changed the way I viewed everything after that. And I always used to say, you know, when anything feels hard, never ever forget what it's like to work and what people have to endure in places like this. Now, I know we've lost our manufacturing base, but there's still people all over the world who work like that and risk their lives in their job, and are being intoxicated and poisoned and, you know, don't have rights and don't have unions and, you know, are just there day to day trying to make a living. So you know, and then the thing that happened while I was in the shipyard, I was expelled from the Marxist-Leninist group that I was in anyway. So the whole thing just kind of went up in smoke. So the whole experience for me was so connected to being in this Marxist-Leninist group, who then sent me this letter telling me that I wasn't carrying out the mass line properly anyway. So goodbye to you, and throwing a Coke bottle at the picture of Lenin on the wall of my bedroom in Boston, where I was living, and kind of then moving into community organizing. And it was that transition, I think. It was kind of, okay, I didn't succeed here, but I'm going to go spend, and I spent years living in the inner city, and then and doing community organizing there and trying to help create affordable housing. And it was a very interesting mix of Puerto Ricans and Greeks and Irish, and the same thing, a lot of downwardly mobile middle-class people who were doing the same thing. And I lived in a passive solar house that my husband built. And so it was, it just kind of shifted from workplace to community. And again, if I hadn't had the background that took me into that class, it was really a class transition for me, living and working in these places. I mean, I would never have gone there. I would have gone straight into a professional life and into a suburb. And so, I mean, it's just one thing led to the next. You know, it was like all the politics just, it was a big break, but it all kind of fit together in terms of just my values. I became I worked at Legal Services for 5 years living in Mission Hill in Boston. And that, again, that was a shift from working people to people who were disabled, and working with that sector of the uninsured population and getting kind of coverage for Medicaid and working for health care for all. Back in the 80s in Massachusetts, they were trying to create a single-payer system in the state.
And we still haven't gotten there. We're speaking with Kendall Hale. The book is Radical Passions, A Memoir of Revolution and Healing, brand new out. And you can look on the web at iUniverse.com. That's letter iUniverse.com. Kendall Hale will be speaking this weekend at the Wisconsin Book Festival as part of a 1960s revisited panel, which will include Kathy Wilkerson, Paul Buell, and others. Thank you so much for joining us on Labor Radio. I want to kind of go back now and start really at your beginnings, kind of a typical everyday kid growing up in a typical middle American family, and you come to University of Wisconsin-Madison. And you come in the midst of the kind of the beginnings of a political movement here on campus in opposition to the Vietnam War. Much of it, of course, fueled by people who had been involved in civil rights struggles and so on, fueled and informed, I think. But talk about that kind of eye-opening moment for you when suddenly you said, "This is the life that I want to live. This is where I'm going to put my energy."
Well, it actually, see, my parents, I really have sort of seen the connection later in life to my Mormon heritage. And for a long time, I was in denial of that connection. But as I matured and as I was able to do the research and then do the self-reflection, I really think my whole life path has been a spiritual journey. It's been very political, and later in life it's become very spiritual. But when I look back at what my ancestors, they went on a long march. They were on a long march, and they were really tough, brave, independent-minded. They were going to practice their religion no matter what it took, and to walk all the way out to Salt Lake City from New Hampshire, where they started, was a really long trek. And so, even though my parents had left the Mormon church, their journey was to escape from the conservatism of later, that paradigm. And they broke out of that paradigm and moved to the East Coast. And my father went to Columbia. But they were, he was a student of Marcuse. So they became liberal, and they were civil rights activists, my mother in particular. And that was in Columbus, Ohio. So they went to the March on Washington, which deeply affected me. And I was picketing for fair housing at a very young age because my mom was doing this. And then, of course, my father was one of the early people who found out some of the truth and the facts about the Vietnam War. So I was being fed some, I was typical, but still I wasn't. I mean, I was with parents that were not the typical set of people in Columbus. They were the only white people, as they told me, that went on the bus to the March on Washington from Columbus, which always surprised me. I always thought it might have been half white and half African American, but it wasn't. And so I remember I applied to a lot of Eastern schools and didn't get in, but my father had told me the University of Wisconsin was a really good state university, and I watched, in the days when the media used to report the truth and show us true images, there was a picture of people carrying crosses up Bascom Hall, to Bascom Hall up the hill. And I just said to myself, that's really where I do want to go to school. That's where I belong. And so I was just very, very anxious to get here and to be with peers that thought like I did, because most people in my high school were very conservative and they weren't political. And I was one of the only people that would wear buttons that said, don't trust people, anyone over 30, things like that. I mean, I was one of the few people who was just in a very, you know, get me out of here. I'm very alienated with all the adults around me kind of mentality. And so it was great when I got here, because it was like, wow, I finally found a home and I found a milieu of people that really see how wrong the war is. And then it just sort of took off from there with the student, with the teaching assistant strike, and then the black students and the Black Panthers, and everything kind of just snowballed from there.
You talk a lot in the book about the kind of the whirlwind of being here in Madison, and eventually, you know, hardly going to classes, just going to demonstrations and so on and so forth. And yet, ultimately, I mean, you left that part of your life and took off on a more individual, personal journey. You went out west. Talk a little bit about that, about what drove you to leave Madison and head west, and what that meant in terms of this spiritual journey that you've been talking about.
Well, the reason I actually dropped out, I actually dropped out and then came back and did graduate, but it was the bombing of the Army Mathematics Research Center. That bombing really destroyed the movement, as far as I'm concerned. The anti-war movement and everything was just kind of, people just fled in large numbers. I think a lot of people just quit, or some people graduated, but I was with a group of women. The women's movement had become very strong, and so I was with a group of women who had been together in a guerrilla theater troupe the summer right before the bombing happened, and were planning to leave anyway. They were a little bit older than I was, and I just wanted to get out. I was so frightened and horrified and confused, actually, about what I should be doing. And I feel like I was looking forward to the West Coast to kind of digest a lot of what it meant to have come right up against that kind of violent bombing. And but the incentive was that we were going to go organize working women. It wasn't so much from a Marxist perspective, although there was this notion that we were going to have a women's collective. And we were all in our 20s, you know, and we were going to move there and figure out what that meant. But we were going to wait till we got there. And we went to Portland, Oregon, and tried to figure this out. And it was just mostly we ended up just kind of hanging around and going out to waterfalls and being in the mountains and playing music. And it never really manifested in much of anything. But it was, and then I felt like, well, I don't know what I'm doing. I have no real, we don't have the skills. It was just very confusing. It was nice to be away, but I came back and did graduate because I didn't know how to apply anything that I had learned. In Portland, Oregon was a teeny tiny quiet place. I mean, there had been some activism, but nothing like what had happened in Madison. So I ended up just staying there a short time. Then I came back, and then I went east after I graduated. So.
And we talked a little bit about your time on the East Coast working in the factory and then in the shipyards, and then moving into community organizing in Boston during a time when racial tensions in Boston were very high. I remember the the school segregation issues and so on at that period. What was it like being a white person working in these communities of people where they were stuck there? You were there by choice.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was mixed. I mean, I felt out of place sometimes, and there was that whole tension of, like, there were projects that were largely occupied by people of color on either side of my neighborhood, and there was just a lot of, you know, that period of history. There was a lot of out-of-the-car shootings and drug issues and break-ins. We were broken into a lot, and people were mugged a lot in the neighborhood and chased down the street. And I mean, it was a tough neighborhood. The park behind our house was just totally full of needles and broken bottles and glass, and we would spend time with neighbors cleaning it up. But it was, I mean, I felt like I'm so happy to be part of this revitalization of this particular neighborhood. And I think the real difficulty came when we had children, because I had chosen to put myself there, but when someone was killed near my daughter's elementary school, and we had a tenant that practically burned our house down because she was drugged up, it really got to be questionable, you know, is this really where we want to raise our children? And that was very sad. And that's when we did exercise the privilege of moving to Brookline. And my husband never did like Brookline. He just never could get used to it. I, on the other hand, I think partly because I was a woman and it was always harder for me and always more threatening, the violence and not feeling like I could protect myself. Plus, I had been raped before, and I had just suffered a lot of, like, post-traumatic stress syndrome, I just think, from, you know, just always looking over my shoulder and just things, just feeling like you were so vulnerable. I felt like it was incredible to be in a neighborhood that felt familiar to me as a young person, where I could walk. I had a sidewalk. My children were safe. The park was clean. There weren't dead bodies in the corner, empty lot, and those kinds of things. By then, I was, you know, I was 38, 39, heading towards 40, and it felt like a great relief. Because it was hard, and it was hard on my children.
We're speaking with Kendall Hale. The book is Radical Passions, a memoir of revolution and healing. I want to talk a little bit about your international travels. You visited Cuba, you visited China, you visited Nicaragua. In fact, in Nicaragua, together with your husband, who was a carpenter, helped build a clinic there. But in each of those places, you went in with sort of expectations of what you would find, and the actual experience turned out to be somewhat different than you thought it would be. What kind of impact did that have on your political view? What sort of developments of your politics were engendered by those experiences?
Mm. Well, Cuba was, actually I went to Cuba when I was working in the shipyard, and it was very short. I was there for the International Youth Festival, and I think I was there for only a week. So I had a very idealized, we were mostly in Havana, but traveling around the outside, and I just thought it was the greatest place I'd ever been in my life. It was warm. I'd never been to the Caribbean before. I didn't see any people that looked really deprived. I mean, the truth was, there were some people who came and asked us for our sneakers, but there was nobody begging. There was nobody who looked like they were starving. And they had these beautiful public, you know, instead of having glitzy, you know, commercial billboards, they had billboards that spoke to public health issues, and they were beautiful. They were very attractive, you know, and it just, I just, you know, was with all these jazz musicians, and there were all these incredible. There was a Soviet liner that was there, and we got to go on board the Soviet liner and sing with them. I sang. I was in a band, a women's liberation band, which we didn't talk about, but I was in this band called New Harmony Sisterhood for 8 years, and we did a lot of union labor songs. And so I was asked to sing, and I got to sing to this hall of like all these sailors, so I guess military people, and I sang in English, and that they were like clapping away to Union Maids and all these songs. And so I just thought, and then I was in the Plaza of the Revolution, and I was just very enamored with Fidel Castro at the time. And I didn't see any of the downside because it was just such a exciting, you know, visit and short-lived. And I just kind of was very naive in certain ways. And, you know, I just didn't want to go back to the shipyard. I wanted to stay there because I was having so much fun. And it just looked like this place where capital didn't rule everything. And it was really different to just even in a little bit to see some of that, even though it was a third world country and totally different. So that, at that point, I just felt like, well, everything I've been told and learned in Madison from the people coming back from the Venceremos Brigade is true. And this is just a place, you know, that our government's totally wrong about. And so, but a different thing happened when I went to China. That was later. That was actually really only 2 years later, 1980. And that was after I'd been expelled and the ML movement had kind of fallen apart. But I was, still searching for what I thought were, pieces of theory, or I was thinking if I could just go there. And I actually went on the U.S.-China Friendship Brigade. So it was called Association. The Association. And but there was still a piece of my consciousness that felt like, well, again, I have to say, people have asked me, how could you not have known about the Cultural Revolution? And I said, look, I read Fan Shen by William Hinton. I was here in Madison when graduate students came back, and obviously it must have been possible for people to go there and see worker communes and, you know, certain factories and places where it looked like things were great, because I don't think a whole group of graduate students would come back and just issue propaganda to, it didn't make, you know, so I went there thinking that I was going to see something different than of course I didn't know what I was going to see, but I think again, it was the line had, by 1980, they were already on the four modernization path, but I didn't know that. I had no idea that was happening. And so I kept looking for Mao's, writings, and I couldn't find anything. And the guides, had already kind of decided he wasn't so great. And then I actually heard some firsthand, things about the Cultural Revolution. And I remember being very stunned. I didn't even know if I believed them. It's hard to imagine. I couldn't believe what they were saying, but I had no framework. So it was very confusing and disillusioning, to come back and think, well, I don't understand what two steps forward, one step back. Like, what are they doing? I don't really know what communism means or socialism means at all. You know, it was very challenging to just understand whether this was just because they were undeveloped and they had to go through a capitalist phase and they were realizing they had to do that before they could become, you know, an equal society. And so that was challenging to come back trying to figure it. I didn't find the answers that I was still hoping for at that time.
Talk about Nicaragua, and that was a longer, much longer experience, and there was certainly some hardship in that as well as some successes.
Yeah, I mean, I was attracted again, you know, there were so many people who wanted to help the Sandinistas in the 80s, and many people were going, but my husband is a builder, and he decided, kind of with the inspiration of some women in Esteli who knew a friend of ours who had spent time there, that he would like to build a health clinic, and this was during the embargo. So again, it felt like another chance at revolution. And here we are in a different country, and if it didn't work in China, and if there were other parts of the world that weren't following through, here was a chance to. And I remember people saying that the Sandinistas weren't the rigid Marxist-Leninists that people claimed, that they were more ideologically diverse, and there was more of a an openness and that they weren't following any particular formulas for their path, for their political and economic path. So I think that was part of it. It was, you know, and there were a lot of poets and there was a lot of romanticism still, because there was so many great poets and musicians, and, you know, there was still young people, and it looked like a great place to go and help, and they really needed our help, and they were so, it was an amazing exchange, because they got a clinic and we got to live with people, and it was 10 weeks, and it was really a transformative experience, because it was much longer and we were living in the same conditions and, understanding still how hard their lives were. And, but yet when the woman that I lived with, I didn't speak very good Spanish and she didn't speak any English, but when she would sit down and take out these photographs of herself standing with Fidel Castro and even Che Guevara, and also they were Christians, and it was just incredibly mind expanding for me to feel that these people were really, these were their heroes, and they were such wonderful, strong people, and they wanted this clinic, and these women were just, I mean, they were like the backbone of this community. And then, of course, the Contra War, which we had no idea. I mean, we knew it was going on. That was the hard part, was that they were trying to take Esteli back again, I think for the third time, surrounding the city. And we had to send our daughter back because it was pretty scary and she hadn't been doing well. Her health was failing anyway because there wasn't enough protein and milk, and she was losing weight. But I think just to see the mobilization of people to defend their rights again, and also the clear separation in their minds between us as Americans and Reagan and the Reagan government and the U.S. was very, it was very powerful, very moving, a very spiritual experience actually for me and for them, I think, to know we were taking risks. All the equipment we had to ship through Canada because of the embargo. And there was, you know, not that we were, I mean, there had been some Europeans, there had been some people who had been killed and mishaps happened. And there was that one famous man who...
Yeah, well, you were there right around the time of Ben Linder.
Ben Linder,
Was working working with water pipelines and things like that, and was killed.
And he was killed. So, and to finish the clinic and to see what that contributed, and we know to this day that it's still standing, but it wasn't easy. It was a very tough, frightening situation, but boy, I would never regret any of the things I've ever done, really. I mean, because each one, as you look back, was, I tell young people, you know, you just have to go to developing countries. You can never understand what it's like until you go and live there. You just can't read a book or just go to Europe. Or, I mean, I know countries are developing rapidly and the standard of living is changing in many places, but pick a country that doesn't have the kind of standard of living, and you'll learn quickly what you appreciate about what we have in a way that you never can, and why people want to, why China is on their modernization, because people have been living this way for a long time and they're getting tired of it. They want to have the things we have.
I want to talk about the New Harmony Sisterhood Band, and particularly the importance of culture, both in the political struggles of the 70s and 80s, but also in particularly the women's movement. Talk about the creation of that band and what it meant to be together with a group of women performing in that way.
Well, again, you know, it seems that everything in my life, I never really quite know what I'm doing. I'm always jumping into things. We didn't plan this band. We just started playing together, but it was all women, and the founder was bringing in songs about Sojourner Truth and putting some of the music that she was doing on the banjo to songs that were just, you know, beautiful songs. I mean, and in the beginning, we just played sort of informally for different women's parties. And immediately we realized, wow, there was an audience of women in particular who really wanted to hear lyrics and songs about women's lives, about gay women, about working women, about women of color, about Puerto Rican women, and then many of the women in this group were starting to compose their own music too. So it was very empowering. But the interesting thing about it was, at that time, if you remember, if you were a feminist, the Marxist-Leninists still sort of considered it bourgeois. There was a real clear, strictly kind of, you know, you don't fit in if you're, it just didn't, it hadn't come together clearly in people's minds. But I was so certain of my politics that I really didn't fit in anywhere. I mean, I tried to sing. Well, I advocated within our band to not just sing songs that were just about white, you know, like we sang a beautiful song about Amelia Earhart, and it was wonderful, and people loved that song. But I remember singing a song by Barbara Dane, who was connected to the Guardian newspaper, called Working Class Women, Working Class Woman. And so we just sort of really worked very well together, trying to speak to all these issues. And then it was just incredible because everyone wanted us to raise money for their causes. And we just got broader and broader. We stayed true to the core of the music being about women, but then we brought in anti-nuke songs, and we just kind of, you know, went through a spectrum of wonderful events that we could sing and then more and more men started coming to our concerts too. And then we raised money for battered women's shelters as well as trade union organizations and the beginning of the environmental movement. And it was pretty amazing. It was incredible. It was a wonderful experience.
That whole notion of the women's movement being considered bourgeois, you know, I want to kind of explore that a little bit more, because you, in your life, you have been, you know, a tremendously committed activist involved in, you know, labor struggles, you know, in risky workplaces and so on and so forth. And yet at the same time, you also have the concerns of any mother for raising your kids and building your home and living in a safe place. Talk about how that dovetails with the politics rather than being separated from it.
Yeah, well, I think, again, you know, the women's movement, and I really think this led eventually to the integration of most of us in most men and women. I think one of the greatest contributions that our generation made was on the cultural level. We didn't seize the state. We didn't change the poll. Look where we're at, you know. We opened the doors culturally. We have a man running for president. It was inconceivable. And to have a woman run for president was inconceivable. And I tell young people that is a direct result of the cultural movements that came with interpersonal relationships and taking the personal as political. That was what the women's movement really started on, the personal. There's no difference. And that's what Buddhism really says, too. There's no difference between the inside and the outside, that the anger and the war that is inside of you is the same thing as the anger and the war that's outside until the human race can really reconcile in. There's always going to be the outer warfare. And so I think that the beginning of that started with recognizing that the journey inside and the women's movement pointed the way for that. And then there were so many men being affected by allowing that side of themselves to come forward and to heal and to be able to cry and to be able to be emotional and to access their feminine side. And so then, you know, I had this wonderful husband who I got him after a lot of feminists had already been in relationships with him. But, you know, he really, at that point, you know, I think I realized that to have a family, and actually people were saying to me, I just did a book reading in Boston saying, you know, you have been married 26 years. Do you know that that's a radical thing in this day and age? It used to be traditional, but it is radical. And the reason it's radical is that it takes work. You know, to keep a marriage or any relationship, whether it's heterosexual or gay or straight, or you have to work at it and you have to really work on yourself. And that isn't easy, and that takes commitment. And, you know, a lot of marriages don't last now, and people kind of want their easy button for everything. You know, easy relationships, easy jobs, so I feel like the commitment to children and to to health and well-being. I ended up being a massage therapist and really in teaching yoga and going on this spiritual questing. But I think it interesting, it fits in with peace and inner peace and relationship to self and to other. And then, of course, to the natural world, the environment that we live in is all connected to trying to protect, you know, life and species and plants and learning how to live in harmony with other living beings. So I don't know if that answers your question at all.
Yeah. No, I mean, in the last part of the book, you talk about your the later parts of your life, you know, moving to North Carolina, this getting involved in massage therapy and some aromatherapy and your trips both to Peru and also some of your trips to look at Buddhist
Ladakh. Ladakh was
Ladakh, where the Dalai Lama's center was as well in Dharamsala.
Yeah, I didn't actually go there, but
what I was going to say is you move into this sort of spiritual realm in the later part of the book, and yet the thing that caught my eye or my ear or whatever reading the book is you don't sort of go over the edge, if you will, of spiritualism. You're always kind of looking from the outside at yourself in those situations and at the people in those communities, in those places, whether it be the poor people of India or Peru. I don't even know how to formulate a question about this, but just to say, kind of talk a little bit more about that, if you could, about the combination of sort of the New Age spiritual journey and yet looking at it through the eyes of a New Left activist.
Yeah. Well, again, I guess part of my karma is just I never fit in anywhere. But I think it's because my path is one of integration. And I don't throw out the old, but I'm always trying to look ahead. I'm trying to explore. And so sometimes it makes me unpopular because on my trip to Peru, I wanted to go on this spiritual trip. I was turning 50. It was a celebration. And when I got to Asheville, there is a lot of interesting New Age, ideas there. And I'm a seeker. I mean, it really is true. I have that within myself. That's just who I am. And so I dabble a lot. I mean, one of the things some of it's good. Some of it's I dabble and I explore, but sometimes, I get into places where I know that they're not grounded because I have such a solid grounding, which came from the political side and working in these working class jobs. And also I'm a gardener. I'm very connected to the earth and I've always worked with my hands and, my husband's a builder and I just feel like I right away I can pick up on stuff that just is too, when it gets too airy-fairy, I know your root chakra, you're not connected. I know about the chakras, but you're living up in your crown chakra and you haven't dealt with the issues in your lower chakra, which is about, you know, looking down into reality here, living on the earth, you know. I mean, spirituality includes all of it. It really does. You have to encompass all of it. If you're going to be a human being, you know, you have to, you know, be able to like make a living and work and vote. You know, and I would run into people who said their gurus told them not to be political and not to vote. And it was just like, what are you talking about? That's to me not American spirituality. We're creating our own versions of all of this. And that's what we do best. You know, our culture takes and we digest and look and we figure things out and add to it. And that's a lot what I've done. And I would go to Peru and there was a part of me that would hear and be very open to, the fascinating tales of light beings that came into Peru, perhaps, and maybe these stones were put here by aliens or beings who could move gigantic stones. I mean, I looked at those stones and I couldn't imagine, just like the pyramids, I couldn't imagine how somebody using manual labor could have possibly put these in place. You know, so I'm open to someday maybe we'll know the truth, but also, everywhere I go, I'm seeing the poverty and I'm seeing, you know, how can people who are still barely eking out a living, I mean, it doesn't really matter to them at this point. What they want is modernization and healthcare and education for their children. And some of these white people coming down who have the privilege to explore these from a spiritual perspective is all interesting, but you just have to keep your awareness always, you know, looking at the contradictions. We do live in a world full of contradictions. There's no getting around it. But to not be aware of that is where I think people get into trouble.
We're speaking with Kendall Hale. The book is Radical Passions, a Memoir of Revolution and Healing. iUniverse is the publisher, and you can check on the web at www.theletteriuniverse.com. And Kendall Hale visiting here in Madison, Wisconsin for the Wisconsin Book Festival. We talked a little bit about writing in the car on the way here and about the importance of people writing their stories, especially the stories of, you know, an everyday person going through these movements of the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s and up to today. And I've got to say, it's so hard to interview you because I keep wanting to interact about some of my own stories and my own memories of a lot of these times and movements. But what do you want to leave people with? Why did you feel it was so important to write this book?
Well, the motivation originally was, I feel like when we started as this collective of people, the first group was called Written Out of History, and that was kind of an anthology that didn't get published. And then I continued writing. But I think a lot of us felt that the media image of the 60s was all that, for a lot of us, I think we felt like that was very popular, and people had sort of the protester hippie image and the drug scene and the music. But I think a lot of us wanted to write down the aftermath. What happened to people who grew up and matured and decided to take their values forward in their lives? And we felt, I think particularly those of us who'd been in the factories and had done some of that labor organizing, and then some of us who had been in other countries in Central America, in Nicaragua and other places. There was a woman in the group who had lived in Mexico for 10 years as an expatriate, that we just wanted to record it because we were afraid that it would get lost and that we wanted to just make sure we weren't written out of history. And so I think, you know, that in the beginning, that was the motivation for just starting to write, even though most of us had never written and didn't know how to write creative nonfiction, had to learn how to do that, but were convinced that there was a purpose and maybe we wouldn't necessarily ever be read by masses of people, but that it's important to tell our stories because a lot of us are not famous. They're always the famous people who can write their memoirs and everyone will buy them and, you know, they have big names, but there are so many of us. There are so many people who've just done incredible work quietly, often behind the scenes, sometimes without anyone even knowing what they're doing. And I remember, frankly, being almost the most inspired by some of the people when I was younger who I'd read who just did really hard work, that I was so in awe of some of the things that they managed to live through and to write about. And so I think that tradition of the progressives and the people who are kind of out in the front lines of any issue, that you may feel like, you don't know how to record it, or even if you can't write it, you should try to get somebody else to maybe write it for you, or put it in a song, or put it on a radio interview, or somehow. I think that leaving the stories for people, especially my children, I felt very strongly about having them be able, even just them, and then of course the book's gotten out way beyond just my children, but I think it's an integration book. I also felt like the growing up part. I had a young woman who was 26 read it, and she said, you know, I've read a lot of memoirs by people in the 60s, but what I like about your book is that I found out what happened to you after you grew up, that a lot of people, you see, well, what happened when the revolution was over, when the revolutionary period was over? How did they live the rest of their lives? How did they get meaning out of it? How did they sustain themselves in a non-revolutionary time and a backlash, actually, a right-wing backlash? And so I think that that's an important thing to understand, because you never know what's going to shift out there. You know, you've got to be able to find ways to find inner peace and stability and happiness, regardless of what's going on anywhere around you. You have to find the key to that. And I think that's a lot about the healing part of healing and sustainability, and, you know, relationships and family, and finding a way that you can still relax and enjoy life as you're still continuing to implement and work for what you believe in is really critical. So otherwise, people just burn out. Or the other interesting thing I found is this book has opened up a lot of emotions for people our age. And there are people who left our movement and never looked back and aren't political and went away from it and want to pretend it never happened. And just have buried it. Cause, and, you know, you have to look at the shadow side of a lot of what we did, because there was a lot of painful shadow stuff. But if you don't, if you try to, it's just like anything, denial. The denial is very, it just, I don't think it's healthy. I think it's unhealthy to just pretend, well, or to be ashamed or to not, there's nothing to be ashamed of. We all have things we did, made mistakes. People make mistakes. But they also do good at the same time that they're damaging things that they might have done. You know, we're learning. We're like an experiment. This whole democracy is a work in progress, you know, and we're all part of it.